Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait. The Earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall.
We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang.
Hi, science girls and science guys. Welcome to Splice, Dominican Radio's first, one, and only science variety show. I'm your host, DJ Tortula, and for the next hour, we're gonna zoom back, way back. I mean, all the way back, to start the show off with a bang. The bang. The Big Bang, to be exact. That's right, the show is headed to the very beginning of our universe, so I'm sure you wanna stay tuned in to hear that. Next, we'll talk about the very first beginnings of life as take a brief swim through the primordial ooze and then just keep on going to talk about where our universe is headed and what this all means in the larger context. We'll cover the latest breakthroughs in science as well as talk a little bit about where we think it's headed. So stay tuned, tickle your ears, and spoil your brain for the next hour with Splice on radio.dominican.edu. Before I start talking about the Big Bang, I'd like to start with a brief musical interlude that I hope a lot of you will recognize, and that was just playing to introduce the show. So here's the History of Everything by the Bare Naked Ladies, which is also the theme song to the very popular nerdcore show, The Big Bang Theory.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait. The Earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall.
We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang.
Hey! Since the dawn of man is really not that long, as every galaxy was formed in less time than it takes to sing this song. A fraction of a second and the elements were made. The bipeds stood up straight, the dinosaurs all met their fate. They tried to leap but they were late and they all died.
They closed their asses off the oceans in Pangaea. See, a wooden bada be a set in motion by the same big bang.
It all started with a big bang.
It's expanding ever outward, but one day
have been sick of us debating how we're here. They're catching deer.
We're catching viruses.
Religion or astronomy.
Descartes or Deuteronomy.
It all started with the Big Bang.
Music and mythology.
Einstein and astrology. It all started with the Big Bang.
It all started with the Big Bang.
Quite the introduction. So, as you heard them say, the universe did really start with the Big Bang. But I want you to take a moment to reflect from that song about what it would actually mean to have the entire universe in a tiny little speck. To try to put it in perspective, imagine everything you know about the universe. Try to imagine every school book or pencil or piece of clothing or food that is used in a day by New York City. And everything that's thrown away, just the miles and miles of trash that come from the 8 million people. Now, imagine all the people themselves. Imagine everything you have in your life times 8 million, and then times that by another 800 to represent the total population of the world. Have that picture? Good. Now, I want you to smush all of that together. I want you to smush every person in New York City. Every person in the world, all their things, and try to put it into the size of a pea. And then add to that pea the entire mass of the Earth. And then add to that the entire mass of the Sun and Jupiter and Neptune and all the stars. And just keep adding and smushing and adding and smushing. Add to that another 500 billion with a B universes. And try to cram that in there too. And then just keep compressing until you fit those 500 billion universes with their multiple planets and perhaps even organisms we haven't discovered yet into the size of a speck of dust. And then keep smushing. That's what the Big Bang says, that our universe started out about the size of a tiny fleck, an infinitely small, infinitely dense little speck of mass. This mass was full of energy and heat as it moved around and twisted, and eventually the molecules started to repel each other and the little ball started to stretch. And it never really stopped stretching. It just stretched and stretched and stretched. Stretched so far that we now have the entire universe around us. Edwin Hubble calculated how much the universe expanded each year, around 160 kilometers per second per million light years. That means that at any moment, at this very second, let's watch a second. There you go. The universe expanded. It's huge, hugely expanded beyond probably our comprehension, because our brains aren't even built that way biologically to have it know what kind of expansion that would mean, or how big our universe is, or how infinitely small it once was. How do we know that the universe is expanding? Well, thanks to our friends at NASA and your tax dollars, we have been tracking the expansion of the universe by measuring 15 different stars over time. By looking at these stars' intensities, we can see if they change over time. These changes in intensities tell us whether the universes are getting closer or farther away. You can see some really cool pictures of these galaxies used specifically for this purpose on NASA's website, as well as all their measurements. So this massive expansion that we know occurs thanks to Edwin Hubble, who looked at stars repeatedly and looked at their intensity to such detail that he could tell us that they were actually moving away from us, besides their general rotational transjection. We also have a sign that our universe started with energy. Not just a little energy, actually quite a bit of energy. Enough energy that we still have some floating around us in every second. You might look at space and think it's just this big, massive, empty vacuum, and there's not even like a hope for you if you're out there. Well, I'm here to tell you that despite the look, there is actually some residual radiation left from the Big Bang. Exactly 3 degrees Celsius, a warm, cozy blanket of radiation for maybe some microbe on some different planet we've never seen. I know it sounds not like a lot, 3 degrees, especially since it's only 3 degrees above zero Kelvin, which is absolute zero when nothing moves. But those 3 degrees are our best evidence for the Big Bang. It tells us how much heat and original energy it must have had. So you might be looking around the universe. If you're ever lost in space, you'll be in any point, in the farthest point from any source of energy, still have 3 degrees above Kelvin. Keep that toasty at night. Though it's not even going to come close. 3 degrees Kelvin, which represents approximately negative 270 degrees Celsius, which is roughly enough to kill you in about 1 nanosecond if you are a 37 degrees Celsius body temperature mammal, like myself and I think most of our listeners. There's some debate about the Big Bang, whether it happened all at once or was this gradual expansion. It might not have been a bang at all. In fact, it might have just been a burp, like a little ripple on the outside of the super dense particle of mass and goo and gunk and matter. And this little ripple might have just created enough difference within it to start it to move apart, to create space between atoms. However, whether it was a bang, as in a huge explosion all at once, or a little burp, as in it just started slowly and slowly and slowly expanded, the fact is that about 15 billion years ago, something changed within this little speck of dust that allowed it to change and to make the complex, beautiful universe that we have. From the Big Bang, we also had the first atoms. These minuscule fractions of matter were created in the complete vacuum that existed before the Big Bang. So you might think of a vacuum of space right now, but when we're talking about a vacuum before the Big Bang, it's an actual vacuum. There was no matter, there were no particles, there weren't even light waves or photons outside of this little dense package. So the first atom was remarkable. It was shocking. It was the first thing that had any tiny bit of space around it. So as these particles were heating and moving around and rushing out in their, not happiness to be created since they're inanimate, but the massive amount of energy shifting from energy into matter at the beginning of the universe, we saw that there was an asymmetry favored in the world, this increase in entropy that would continue forever, as we can see in almost every life form now. That when the Big Bang happened, you had this uniform tiny mass of energy and matter, and then it started to change and become different and mutate. And in that process, chaos increased rather decreased, which is weird to think about our entire universe being embrace of chaos, since we have so many logical science rules and ideas about how ordered and structured and logical and cause and effect, and then to look back at the Big Bang and not actually know the origin of these differences. But it happened with the very first atom. And then further from this atom, the core started to expand. And as it expanded, it created more and more matter from energy. And this matter became all the particles around us today. And these particles have lots of space around them. And it's really unique, especially in the early universe, to not be in a separate state of energy and to actually be in a state of matter. And further, for that state of matter to be forcefully separated from other states of matter. So, in conclusion, the Big Bang, a very diverse but not terribly well-known subject, our evidence to believe that our universe started this way has a lot of mathematics and also astrophysics. But the neutrons, the energy transfer, and the electromagnetism we see today all suggest to some extent that the Big Bang occurred, as does the background radiation we've seen across the entire universe, that 3 whole degrees Kelvin that's present ubiquitously throughout the universe we've explored at the very least. And I think that's how the world began, and that's what science supports. So you can visit my Facebook page or do some research yourself, and please come back after a brief musical science symphony featuring Stephen Hawking about the Big Bang.
I'd like to start, if I may, with Professor Hawking. How did the universe start? With a Big Bang?
We observe that distant galaxies are moving away from us. They must have been closer together in the past. It was the beginning of the universe and of time itself. Anything that happened before the Big Bang could not affect what happened after.
The poetry of the expanding universe. The poetry of the complexity of life. We're not normally equipped to understand, but science gives it. Science is opening your eyes to the wonderfulness of what's there. Science is opening your eyes to the poetry of the expanding universe.
To come to you, Carl Sagan, could you help me by putting into layman's terms what was involved with this Big Bang?
The early cosmos was everywhere white hot. But as time passed, the radiation expanded and cooled. Pockets of gas began to grow, steadily brightening. We call them the galaxies.
It was the beginning of the universe, and of time itself. Anything that happened before the Big Bang could not affect what happened after.
The poetry of the expanding universe. The poetry of the complexity of life. We're not normally equipped to understand, but science gives it.
In the Big Bang, we had equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And as soon as these met each other, they annihilated together. And this battle played out whilst the universe expanded in its first moment of existence.
They annihilated together.
And this battle played out whilst the universe expanded in its first moment of existence.
They annihilated together.
It's not all that hard to detect the Big Bang. All you need to do is change the channel until you come between two stations.
All you need to do is change the channel.
About 1% of the snow and noise comes from the Big Bang itself. We're all eavesdropping on the birth pangs of the cosmos.
It was the beginning of the universe and of time itself.
And this battle played out.
Science is opening your eyes. The poetry of the expanding universe.
And this battle played out whilst the universe expanded in its first minute of existence.
It was the beginning of the universe and of time itself.
All right, listeners, I hope you enjoyed that. There are other science symphonies. You can just type that into YouTube and they'll pop up on a wide variety of subjects. I think they're great. They incorporate a lot of lectures and even old Discovery Channel programs and use it to make a nice little song about often physics or genetics. So check that out. On a couple last notes about the Big Bang before we talk about the news of the day, there's some discussion about what happens when the next Big Bang comes. And while that seems weird to talk about what about the next creation of the universe, a lot of science supports the idea that our universe in time is not actually linear as you think of it, like seconds ticking by, but actually a giant circle. So that the process of the Big Bang will actually be repeated rather soon. So you start with a massive, dense mass. It expands and expands and expands over billions and billions of years until the space cannot support itself, and then it stops expanding and actually starts to collapse upon itself. And from this, you get the creation of another giant mass. This mass is only stable for so long until, once again, it starts to expand and expand and expand and then collapse. There are other scientists who say that's totally wrong. That's complete nonsense, but there's a lot of physics to support this, and if you're wondering where the matter came from in the first place, it makes a lot of sense to have a circular view. The circular view also is kind of a nice life view to imagine that we come out of the same matter and we'll go back to the same matter ultimately. And that the entire universe is kind of a closed system in that way. And who knows what the next Big Bang and the next cycle will bring. That being said, let's take a brief look at both the science and political news of the day. So I don't know if you guys have been following this, but there's been a lot of debate about the budget, perhaps due to the election, between class warfare versus taxes on the rich. And you might be wondering, why would I talk about this on a science show? Well, you have to realize that most science is done not by an isolated mad scientist in the basement somewhere, but actually by a group of citizens who just decide to come together to dedicate their lives and then to try to get support for those ideas they care about to develop them. So when we talk about tax structure or social welfare, it affects science a lot by affecting the types of communities and conversations that scientists can have. In other news today, Clinton, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is working, maybe, for the Palestine Compromise. If you hadn't been following the news lately, Palestine is looking for statehood. Not statehood, but recognition from the United Nations Council. And this is an issue because it is opposed by Israel, and it becomes a serious conflict of interest between Israel's allies and recognizing Palestine. Earthquakes this afternoon struck the southeastern part of Guatemala, causing at least one death. There's been recent talk about global warming actually increasing the amount of shift in tectonic plates, perhaps causing the recent uprise in earthquakes we've seen. There's also been talk about how heavy structures and a changing of the mass caused by cities and mines might also impact tectonic plates. Being in California, you probably know that California and most of its major cities are actually on a fault line. A lot of other major cities are also, including Japan, obviously, and all those cities in the Ring of Fire, as well as Las Vegas, where I'm originally from, and a couple others, including some in Florida. So these major cities on tectonic plates, it's uncertain if it has enough impact to actually affect something as massive as a giant tectonic plate, but more is to be looked into, especially given these current circumstances. And our last news story of the day is that whooping cough vaccinations are rapidly falling. After a 3-year uprise, mainly brought about by a resurgence of cases within the United States of whooping cough. What does this teach us? Get your children vaccinated regularly and make sure they get their boosters, because you might think these diseases are outdated, but there's usually some mutation or variation still floating around, and given the opportunity, and just a couple unvaccinated people can begin to start like a key that the bacteria can get into and start to have a stronghold within a population. So whooping cough's unpleasant and unpleasant to listen to. So think about getting your children vaccinated. And if you're an adult, think about getting yourself vaccinated. I know that if you work in a hospital or healthcare field, you have to make sure your boosters are up to date. So it doesn't hurt anything. There are very limited side effects. And you can help yourself, your neighbors, and maybe your children or your nieces and nephews, all those people you care about, and the people you don't care about, but the people you care about are probably more important. Finally, let's finish up with some science news. By far, my favorite science news story of the week has to do from the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic is a major medical institution in the United States that does some great research, including on a wide variety of healthcare topics. Recently, they just released a study they did with kittens. What's so special about these kittens, you might ask? Well, these kittens were genetically engineered to have green fluorescent protein. That means these kittens glow. Cool, but not enough to, you know, actually have an impact on the medical field, you would think. Except these kittens were used in an HIV study. Scientists transjected GFP protein to try to help cure feline immunodeficiency virus, which is the feline homologue or parallel to the human immune deficient virus, which many of you know causes AIDS. The Mayo team wanted to mimic the way evolution would help create protective proteins, except almost speed up the process. They took monkey versions of effective protective proteins against HIV. They inserted them into cats, and then these cats with this antiviral protein known to block HIV infection were injected along with the jellyfish gene that glows for green fluorescence proteins into feline eggs. These eggs were then born into cute little baby kittens. And these kittens, if they had this gene for both the protein against HIV as well as the green fluorescent protein, would of course glow green under blue light, flashlight. You can see really cute pictures of these kittens online at sciencenews.org or Nature, where this paper was published. Some of you might be wondering about the state of animal testing, especially with genetic engineering, and how soon these therapies can move into humans, and how much is actually applicable back to humans. These are all excellent questions that I will talk about more next week when I'm doing a special show about the topic most close to my heart, genetics. And specifically, I'll be doing two little brief segments, one on genetics and then another one on stem cells and stem cell genetics. So be sure to tune in. I definitely love the subject. And I think it's the latest breaking new science out there that'll be soon at your doorstep. And by soon, I mean in a couple decades, to help you get through the worst, the best, and the unexpected in your life. So tune in next week to Splice on radio.dominican.edu from 6 to 7, just like you are now. In other science news, not kitten-related, so not nearly as fun, there's been a couple recent psychological studies on obesity so that the brain can actually sabotage your body if you train it differently. So when the brain knows that the body isn't hungry, obese people's brains, when studied under an fMRI, actually respond to food with the same intensity of desire, even after having just eaten. This means that researchers are following up the lead that this could rewire a person's neural system to reinforce positive feelings about eating, not actually related to the endorphins released by eating the food itself. The study... 5 lean people and 5 obese adult volunteers were shown pictures of food such as ice cream, french fries, or cauliflower. Actually, it's really good if you cook it with garlic. But shown pictures of food, and throughout the research, they were asked to show their rate their hunger levels and how much they wanted that particular food. Volunteers were scanned for several hours, and then researchers used insulin pumps to establish volunteers' blood sugar levels as a marker of how hungry they were or how much in food they were, how much food they were in need of. All volunteers reported wanting food, especially the high-calorie food when showed the pictures, especially when glucose levels were low. However, the obese patients showed the same high-quality or high desire for food even when their blood glucose level was high, especially compared to the lean patients who showed a much more decreased desire for the food. This is only one of a number of fairly recent studies using fMRI to explore the nature of our human brain. And almost all these studies relate back to how we actually reprogram our brain as we go to kind of support our habits. So good habit formation is very important. Start early rather than later, because literally you won't be able to control yourself, because yourself, as in your consciousness, as in your brain, has been trained in a way you can't think yourself out of too well. Subconsciously, it's doing all sorts of madness to make sure that you continue those habits which have rewarded it in the past. It's almost very similar, they found recently, between drug use, internet use, and by internet use, I mean multi-tab, multi-action, multi-game internet use where you're having constant stimulation, and sugar. So it's not just chemically altering substances, it is actually your habits. On the plus side, if you get good habits, your brain can also be trained to those. So let's say you start exercising, you might find yourself actually enjoying and desiring and getting weird impulses to exercise. Lots of psychology that you can use for your own personal benefit to make yourself as interesting and active as you desire. So I'm going to take a quick musical break and have you listen to The Galaxy Song by Monty Python, which is one of my favorites. And every time I'm thinking about my place in the universe or my habits or getting a little arrogant, I love to listen to this song. It really puts things in perspective, almost like the Big Bang. So I hope you enjoy.
Listen to this. Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned, a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way. Our galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us it's just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is only one of millions of billions in this amazing and expanding universe.
Thank you.
keeps on expanding and expanding in all of the directions it can whiz. As fast as it can go, at the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, 'cause there's bugger all down here on Earth.
Hey, welcome back. This is Splice on radio.dominican.edu, Dominican University's one and only science variety show. I'm your host, Rutula, and in this last part of our show, we're going to be talking about the primordial soup and the beginning of life. So we've covered the Big Bang, we've talked about some of the news and how that relates to science and some of the exciting parts. And now we're going to talk about how actually our life came into existence and kind of how we got here, even more so than how the Earth and the planets and the atoms got here. So as we talked about earlier, the world began as this sort of massive ball of infinitely dense, infinitely hot, infinitely small matter and energy. And then expanded and expanded and expanded into the giant, complex, and beautiful universe we know today. How, though, did after all this matter expanded and then atoms started to clump together and they started to form planets and these planets started to form gravitational poles and the matter started to interact and with all the forces that we currently know today? However, at what point did this matter move from this increasing entropy constantly in the universe since the Big Bang, where everything became more and more and more disorganized? As one of the laws of thermodynamics states very clearly. So how did this actually bring about a substance that decreases the entropy within itself? And by decreasing the entropy, I mean it gets more and more organized. And when I talk about these substances, it really means life. How did life come to be? This question puzzled people for many, many years. Until around the 19th century, people still believed in spontaneous generation, which is kind of a science way of saying they had no idea. They believed that certain forms of life, basically simple forms of life, did not reproduce themselves, but actually spontaneously came out of non-living matter. For example, Aristotle talks about how hay actually gives rise to fleas, rather than fleas giving rise to fleas. And that kind of explained why rotten meat would give maggots, or hay would have mice, or things like that, when you might not observe reproduction taking place near or anywhere around those items. One of my favorite ones is an old African idea that crocodiles were born from rotten logs at the bottom of bodies of water. There's actually this tale about a boy going down to go fish out a rotten log that turns into a crocodile, and he wants to go get it before and is just a little too late. Little too late has the crocodile get him, but it's being proactive, which is something admirable, I think, in any context. However, even though it was believed until the early 19th century, around the 17th century, some of these examples started to be questioned. Why, how could these life forms appear when other life forms, and that mice might not be as complex, depending who you talk to, as humans, but they certainly aren't something that would spontaneously generate from a pile of hay. So as science was evolving in the 17th and 18th century, they started doing tests about spontaneous generation. One of the most famous ones was Francisco Reedy in 1668, who looked at maggots in rotten meat, and he put a screen over the rotten meat to see if maggots would form. and there were no magnets. However, if he put a screen that allowed air through, the flies could smell the rotten meat, and actually, they would lay their larvae on top of this mesh that he put over the meat. However, this was not enough to convince critics. Some of them actually said the fumes from the meat caused the maggot formation, not the actual meat itself. Others said that his original experiments did not allow enough air or what was considered a vital life force, since oxygen was not well understood at the time, into the meat area, and thus life could not live. However, experiments continued, people weren't discouraged, and eventually Louis Pasteur in 1861, in one of his favorite experiments, demonstrated that organisms such as bacteria and fungi actually travel through the air to infect substances rather than the substances spontaneously generating themselves. So he took a vial of nutrient broth, he heated it, and then he twisted the top of the vial into this little curve so that the microbes would fall out of the air, but the air could still flow through into the vial. And he left this for a year and just watched it and didn't touch it, and nothing grew. And then he just snapped off the top and things grew the next day. And he pretty eloquently showed there was likely no biogenesis, and that all cells had to come from other cells. From here, when we discovered cells did not come from matter, came the question, well, where did cells come from? And if there's only matter after the Big Bang, why were there cells afterwards? And this leads us to the primordial soup, which wasn't actually investigated well until around the 20th century, years later. One of the most famous experiments proposes that life was actually spontaneously generated from the building blocks present, the amino acids and the carbons present at the start. In 1952, Miller Urey did this great experiment where they took a mixture of water, hydrogen, methane, and ammonium, which is what was considered to be present in an early Earth atmosphere. And they just sparked the mixture repeatedly. And with this addition of concentrated energy, they found that 10 to 15% of the carbons actually formed organic compounds, including amino acids. These amino acids are really important in the formation of proteins, and proteins are really important in the formations of life. For those of you who aren't familiar, the entire purpose of DNA, the building blocks and blueprint of our cells, is just to make these proteins. So the current model after these experiments holds that it is likely that early Earth was primarily composed of methane, ammonia, water, hydrogen sulfide, carbon dioxide, and maybe carbon monoxide, and phosphates, along with molecular oxygen and ozone, though these were rare or absent, depending on who you talk to, the oxygen and ozone. So electric activity in this sort of primordial ooze of compounds can lead to the creation of certain small molecules, as demonstrated in the Miller-Urey experiment, as well as in other experiments later on. These phospholipids can form bilayers, which is the basic component of a cell membrane. So the real question after all of this is, what was the first molecule that self-replicated? The current theory is heavily towards random RNA molecules, which is a self-replicating ribosomes, or some people also believe in self-replicating proteins. These self-replicating proteins can be enzymes, and these enzymes can actually In some cases, such as ribosomes, try to transcribe mRNA, which eventually leads to proteins. So this could be the first idea of a self-replicating molecule, and these self-replicating molecules, which came out of this crazy chaotic primordial ooze, might actually eventually have led to this decrease in entropy as they became more and more organized. So we can't zoom back to the original beginning of the universe, but it is likely that we kind of came out of chaos, and from chaos came order, and from order came our current state, however you want to call it. So this has been our show on the beginning of life, the primordial ooze, the Big Bang, and all that's happening in the world of science. I know it might not have been the smoothest ride, but thanks for sticking with me here on Splice on radio.dominican.edu. This was the very first show, but not the last. Next week, you can join us again. I'll be talking about genetics. I hope to have a very, very special guest talk about the bioethics of genetic engineering, talk about how genetics affect our personality and who we become, and also, hopefully, talk a little bit about what's happening in the news today. And what you can look forward to in the next hour is some more great radio broadcasts from radio.dominican.edu. And that will be the Power Hour. Actually, excuse me. First, we have Hotspot with DJ Juice, and then the Power Hour with Sam I Am. And then, lastly, to wrap up the night, from 9 to 10 p.m., we have the 9 o'clock lounge with Too Mellow. So, your science is done for the day, your daily dose of all that is nerdy information and such has been concluded. Thank you for listening. I hope to see you again next week. And I hope I've sparked your interest and maybe even sparked a protein or two in the process. All right. Thanks for listening. Finish up with another song I really like called Science is Real by They Might Be Giants.
Science is real. From the Big Bang to DNA, science is real. From evolution to the Milky Way, I like those stories about angels, unicorns, and elves. Now I like those stories as much as anybody else. But when I'm seeking knowledge, either simple or abstract, the fact science, the factor with science. Science is real. Science is real. Science is real. Science is real.